Hello and welcome to Black Hat White Hat, brought to you by eSentire, the leaders in active threat protection. I'm Ben Hammersley, your regular host, but you won't be hearing much from me this week. No, this is the guy who's sitting in my chair.
I'm J. Paul Haynes, eSentire's CEO.
Jay and his team are at the RSA conference in San Francisco, where the world talks security, as they say. And this week on Black Hat White Hat, he's joined by the finest names in the business. Author Shane Harris, who looks at the actual landscape of cybersecurity. Where do the threats reside and how dangerous are they really? Then from a man whose previous life is classified, Lieutenant General Ronnie Hawkins tells us how the military and the agencies protect themselves before a threat is exposed and exposes us. Stay tuned for the need to know. This is Black Hat White Hat. Author and journalist Shane Harris has spent most of his career looking at how government infiltrates everyday lives. Now he's turned his eyes to cyber as senior intelligence and national security correspondent at the Daily Beast. His latest book is At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Jay began by asking him what's piqued his interest on the conference floor.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting is, like last year, but especially even with the renewed focus, you're seeing a lot of officials from Washington coming here to the conference, particularly Defense Secretary Ash Carter, who was here earlier, really trying to, I think, repair a lot of, I think, what is a diminished trust, maybe a breach of trust, some people might like to say. In Washington, it's you really, in talking to government officials, get a sense that they feel that they have not done enough to really go out and reach out to Silicon Valley after the Snowden leaks and try and repair damage that they think was done. They were already trying very heavily in government to recruit people from this part of the country and sort of form those bridges with industry. But there's a lot of, you know, repair work that's being done on that. And Carter was out here, interestingly, talking about new ways that they could enlist hackers into a program that he wants to do, where it's sort of a bug bounty for the Pentagon, where he wants to vet some hackers. They'll have to do background checks, which I found to be a little interesting. But essentially saying, hey, come and try and do some penetration testing against DoD networks.
Basically red team the DoD?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
Which I thought was sort of interesting, right? Now they have their own red teamers as well. Maybe they'll learn some new stuff.
Yeah.
But so there's also, I think, that's a little bit of like a diplomacy that's kind of going on. And you feel that theme here, that there is a, we're also talking about this, they're doing a podcast now while Apple and the FBI are doing battle with each other over encryption and access to phones. This tension between Washington and Silicon Valley is really palpable. So I've noticed, you know, conversations around how do you improve that. And some people, I think, don't want to improve it. Some people are very fine with the tension the way it is.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think to a company on the trade show floor here, there's nobody who would agree that the industry should give a backdoor on the crypto on the iPhone. It's just, it's because the hackers will find it, ultimately. If you build it, they will find it.
I have to say, in my conversations, just, you know, anecdotally with people too, they seem very much to be in that position. And not just because I think of any kind of lingering mistrust over the Snowden leaks. I think it's a much more, and maybe people in Washington don't quite get this yet, a more deeply felt principle of we cannot engineer products and then sell them that are not safe. And you see Apple making this argument and others making it in Washington now. And it's starting to get through to people that this isn't just about security and it's not just about necessarily one case involving the San Bernardino shooters, but a more kind of bedrock principle for industry.
Civil liberty.
Yeah, civil liberties as well. I mean, there's already a very, you know, sort of a strong community of interest there that you have in Washington. That's going to be kind of a natural partner for people who are fighting for this position that Apple has generally took. This is going to be a big, big political fight in Washington, and you're going to see Congress weigh in on this, I think. So as you're making policy now about what to do about encryption or the iPhone or these devices, you have to think 3 years ahead to what the state of play is going to look like from the threat actor's perspective as well. And that's just that's a kind of like forward-thinking policy making that, you know, candidly, Washington doesn't do so great. It's going to be a huge challenge.
Yeah, a few governments do, for that matter.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So coming back to the RSA conference, in Emmett Uran's keynote, one of the things that he was underscoring was the notion of hunting teams. And let's set aside for the moment, you know, whether mass surveillance is right or wrong. The technique works. It was invented, the tradecraft was invented by the agencies and the military to be able to go into networks and hunt and ask questions. And the challenge that you have in the industry automating security technology is it is really damn hard to tell a computer how to know which next question to ask. And that's what hunting teams do. They use a lot of tools and tech to get there, but you need gray matter to make that decision to ask which is the next question. And so So he said, he submitted that you pretty much, if you don't have a hunting team, you should grow your own. Now, the problem is the skill set required is some of the most advanced out there. And we've also heard, you know, 2.2 million fewer threat analysts available in the world than demand right now. So what we have seen and we've built to solve the commercial problem is basically the same as mass surveillance. You collect every piece of data because you don't know what you're going to need. So when the hunters go on the hunt, they have to have access to everything. And that's kind of the approach that we've taken for the last several years and how we've solved it for the commercial entities. But let's go to, you know, dig into some of what you have discovered in terms of mass surveillance and how well that that technique has worked for them.
Yeah, well, you mentioned, you know, amassing the data so that you can essentially, you know, be able to know, you know, you don't know exactly what you're looking for at a given moment, so you collect the haystack in order to find the needle. I mean, this is something that the National Security Agency, and particularly when Keith Alexander was running it, really was, I think, kind of a guiding philosophy. And a lot of people criticize that. I mean, particularly after the Snowden leaks, of saying that this looks like you're sort of spying on everyone. And so the agency has really had to do a lot of work to try and, you know, articulate its position as, no, we're just looking for the bad guys. But it does involve a huge amount of data collection. And really what I find, you know, so interesting is that these techniques frequently will develop in the military and in the intelligence community where they have the resources to do this. And the time, exactly, to do it. And it's not a competitive market environment. It's, you know, it's an objective-oriented, mission-oriented kind of environment. And then, of course, that technique and those technologies migrate out. I mean, one of the things you do is the point of gray matter that I think has been so interesting to track is NSA will pay for young people to go through college for 4 years, get their computer science degree, if they agree to come then work for the NSA for 4 years. So many people who I've interviewed have gone through programs like that, and then they go into the private sector, which from the NSA's perspective is not necessarily a bad thing. Yes, you're losing that resident talent in the agency, but they come out of the agency with that high-end training that you're talking about, where they're learning, you know, the real-world hunting techniques. Like, they've actually done it, and they've done it in an operational context. So in one way, I think that if NSA is interested in trying to improve, or the government writ large even, let's just say, overall security, training those people who then go out into companies and then have the gray matter to do that, that's one way of it perhaps working, is sort of, you know, training up a class of people who then, yes, you lose them in government service directly, but who know how to go out and do it in the private sector. I think that trend is only going to continue.
Who's really in charge here? Who's patrolling the internet? And is there really anyone that has the full picture? I'm not sure that there is. We have our view of it, and it's very much over 90% opportunistic criminal activity.
Yeah, I think no one really has the full picture. And if you ask, you know, I'm sure President Obama probably would agree with this, but when I talk to national security officials, what really keeps them up at night is a hack on the power grid, right, that disables power to a large segment of the population, taking out communications networks, disrupting financial systems, and not just, you know, defacing bank websites and not even a financial crime, but something that would undermine confidence in the financial system and the infrastructure set up to process information. These are the really sort of big nightmare scenarios, which, of course, are low probability, right? There are plenty of reasons why China is not going to try to crash Wall Street. It would not be in their interest. China has a lot tied up in the health of the U.S. economy. Now, that does not mean that some, you know, rogue actor Russia might even, you know, as a provocation, try to do something to sort of test us that could escalate very quickly. But those are the big things that they're worried about. No one that I've talked to in government, while they're aware of the sort of the panoply of threats out there, particularly financial crime, individual records theft, thinks that it's necessarily per se their job to protect it. What they see themselves as trying to do is facilitate like some kind of relationship with the industry to say, are there ways that we can tell you about things that we're seeing? Is there information that we can give you that would be useful for you to protect your own systems? But that's really putting the onus back on industry. Government doesn't do a great job of sharing that information with industry. And most people in industry, I think, have said, look, the government's not coming to my rescue. I'm going to have to get smart on my own. Now, the flip of that is that as companies have invested in more surveillance, in more threat analysis, as they've hired smart people, you are seeing, you know, intelligence reporting coming out of some, you know, some companies that frequently looks as sophisticated as the kind of thing that you would expect to be seeing coming out of a government agency. It may not be the product of hacking into a foreign system, but it's pretty darn good stuff. Government, I think, is generally pleased with that development. They want to see an industry that is, you know, flourishing in the threat intelligence space, that is advising companies on how to protect their networks, because it means that they don't have to do it. But in terms of like where there's sort of one place where they can see all of it, you know, no. I mean, look, NSA likes to hold itself out as the agency that can see things that those private actors can't, because they can hack into foreign government networks and they have a different appreciation of the threat. But I don't think anybody would be able to credibly claim that they've got their finger on the pulse of all of it. It's just too big and nebulous of a problem for one central actor to control. And, you know, and to the Obama administration's credit, I don't think it is trying to centrally control it either.
It sort of leads me into the thought of, you know, the playing field isn't level. The bad guys ignore all the laws and the rules. There's no upside in it for them. And, you know, when you do things like, you know, in our investigative, in our threat intelligence teams, we go upstream, we follow the IPs. Then, you know, we are theoretically trespassing in someone else's property.
I mean, you did not use the term hack back. But that term gets a lot of play, you know, in the
conversation. Well, it's offensive cyber, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's, you know, or active defense is the, one of the terms that I like. Look, people in the national security community absolutely know that companies are not going to sit around waiting for the government to come protect them. They are going to take steps to actively defend themselves and their customers. And I was actually, you know, surprised. Most of the people I talked to from law enforcement and from the intelligence community were very much on the side of companies doing that. Now, they weren't advocating for a company to do something that was illegal, but they were also saying, you know, have very good lawyers and know what the limits are, and we trust you in many ways to know what the limits are. For companies that do this, yeah, it's risky, and they have to be very careful because they don't have the authorities that the government has. I mean, the government is benefiting from companies doing that in many ways.
It's one thing to go into, you know, to the other person's premise and acquire the information about who they're hacking. It's a completely different scenario to go in and blow it up. And I got a great team of guys who know how to go in there and blow it up. But the site that could be mounting the attack could be a compromised real commercial entity. So you just can't go and blow it up willy-nilly.
Right.
You have to have unequivocal G2 on that. Otherwise, you're taking you're getting into other risky territories.
Yeah.
So you know, if you look at the cyber kill chain, which is, you know, got a lot of air cover the last couple of years, the thing that's not on it is destroy, which is the last step of the kill chain.
Right. And the military would say, please leave that to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, back to your point, you know, at what point does industry say, hey, look, I got to take care of myself, boys. If you can't help me, I got to start blowing stuff up.
Yeah, I read about this in the book, and I predicted that you're going to see the first private sort of offensive strike you're going to see is likely going to be from a bank. You know, some institution that has a lot to lose, that is under constant threat, that is just going to say, I cannot sit here and take this risk anymore. I am going to have to actively go out and neutralize that threat. And when that happens, the potential for blowback is big. If it's ever discovered, we're going to have a gigantic discussion about that in Washington. But I don't think anybody who follows this will really be all that surprised. I think it's a matter of time before private organizations start to act in an offensive mode.
Yeah. So one of the things that's important is jurisdiction. And most of the jurisdictions where the hacking is being done is not our jurisdiction. So even working with law enforcement in Interpol, I mean, they have a system for sharing intel, but it literally takes 6 months, if you talk to the agencies, to get boots on the ground to prosecute a warrant. So it's basically, we've done speeches with the FBI where the agents giving the speech said, look, it's the Wild West. We can't help you. You better buy a sidearm and defend your own fort.
Yeah.
That's the world that we're in here.
Yeah. Exactly.
That was Shane Harris with eCentire CEO J. Paul Haynes on the floor at the RSA conference in San Francisco. So, are things as bleak as Jay and Shane suggested? We got an insider's view of the theatre of cyber war from recently retired veteran cyber warrior, Lieutenant General Ronnie Hawkins. Well, what he could tell us, that is. His resume is so extensive, we've linked to it on our website, blackhatwhitehatpodcast.com.
I believe in your tenure, your group coined the term advanced persistent threat, which is, it sounds Hollywood. It actually has a pretty good definition in your world. I don't think that we see that same degree of persistence in, say, criminal threat actors you're dealing with nation states, it's the 9-to-5 job, and they got time on their hands. What we see in the industry is the average time to detect, you know, depending on which report you read, is, you know, in excess of 250 days, and 90% of the time you're getting that intel from a third party because you don't know what you don't know. Is there any lessons that you learned in the military? Because you basically were dealing with the tradecraft that we're faced now 8 years ago.
Certainly. Well, the one thing that we've learned is that the what we call the cyber kill chain, it has its links in there, and there are also vulnerabilities that are tied to it. Once you get down to the sixth level of the cyber kill chain, and you're into the command and control and weaponization of a capability, the adversary is allowed to move laterally in it, all the way across an entire network. And until you know that that adversary is even in, and oftentimes we would not know that, you don't even realize how they're moving laterally. So the thing that we realized was that the endpoints that we have, the defensive posture that we have at the endpoints, is important. You have to have the defensive cyber hygiene, is what we call it, to make sure all of your patches are up to date. But you need to also be able to get inside your own network and start hunting, to do what I call move the flash to bang back to the left. Because we were having times where the adversary was inside the network for a period of time and we didn't know it as well. And I'll just leave it at that time frame. But there is a science and an art to moving that boom or that flash to bang back to the left that is needed both in industry as well as in the Department of Defense. So how it is that we train up our hunting teams within the Department of Defense is critical to how you're able to work through the entire cyber kill chain.
You almost have to get in the head of the adversary.
Certainly do.
To know what their motives are. We've done lots of panels and speeches with law enforcement, and one of the terms that continues to ring true is means, motive, and opportunity. And if we kind of look through that lens on the sort of criminal-minded threat actors whose main mission is to monetize their exploit.
Right.
It's a very different mission than I think you were dealing with, which was generally non-monetization. It was information acquisition, right?
Definitely, and it was all about the data and what you do. Initially, we always thought that it was a digital landfill and nobody was going to be able to get to the information. And now with the data analytics that are going on and the powerful computers that are able to crunch the data, it is about the data. And more importantly, the adversary, be it a nation state or an adversary that's an individual or a group of individuals, they want to get the data to either embarrass the United States or use it against us from a different type of threat posture. So all of those things come into play when you start to look at what goes on within the department.
Mm-hmm. You know, just by way of background, we have a lot of threat intel-based defensive measures. You know, there's been a victim zero somewhere. We've learned from it. We can take countermeasures. So if that same tradecraft is coming at us, we can at least defend what we know how to defend. And it gets more difficult when you start dealing with something that's never been seen before. So we have capabilities to detect embedded executables, and we manage that against trusted whitelisted sites. And then if that's not catching things and it leaks through that level, then we're dealing with behaviors. And behaviors are very challenging because in and of themselves, the indicator of time of day or a new protocol being used, or flow surges, or geolocator, IP reputation tests. Any one of those may, in and of itself, not be a strong enough indicator. It's a weak signal. But we take that signal and we enrich it. And we have our analysts have to make a decision, is this weird normal, or is this weird investigate? And if it's weird investigate, they go on the hunt. And that hunt, for us, could involve, you know, grepping a 1 terabyte file, looking for an embedded IP, pivoting and diving into adjacent networks using that information. And we do this very much to solve that commercial mission. Is there parallels to what you have done in your past? I mean, not talking at the classified level, but in terms of that method and that technique?
Well, the hunt teams within the department are doing something very similar and analogous to what takes place within ECNTIR. The one thing that I would say that I gravitated towards ECNTIR because of what the hunt teams were doing is what I call the operational rigor. to what goes on within the SOC. And to have the types of briefings that take place prior to a team coming on active duty, and also to have that team also pass that along to the other locations is critically important. And so that piece of that information sharing, and then playing it back months later to find out, are there any other back doors, if you will, that have not been uncovered or have not been covered, that's critical as well. And I believe Simon is the area that you have within your capability right now. Those are things that the hunt teams within the department are doing also. And it's analogous to I believe oftentimes the best defense is a good offense. And so you bring those offensive players over, you have them train the defensive players to understand what it is that they're hunting for and what it is that they're looking for. So I believe that's critically important to how we go about doing our business.
Yeah, we've found over 15 years that always challenge to know what that next question is. Sure. In automation. So we use tons of automation, analytics, and so forth. But we have to insert a human in there for at least 35 or 45
somewhat.
Seconds.
Yeah, right.
To make that decision, that last mile, that last bit of gray matter correlation, as we call it.
So that goes back to what I've spoke of with the risk mitigation and understanding the what ifs as a result of, if we do this, what might happen? If we don't do this, what might happen? And it all plays back together into looking at the next scenario that could happen as a result of the action that you take or do not take.
Yeah. You know, we focused all of our efforts around commercial, but in the scope of where you were coming from, where the networks were more complex, is there maybe a methodology in hunting that you can share with us without getting too classified?
Well, the basic methodology comes down to how it is that we establish the hunt team and they go out and do the hunting. And where I'm going with that is there is a briefing that takes place prior to a hunt team coming on duty. They talk about what it is that they're going to be looking for, how it is that they will utilize the tools that they have at their disposal to try to discover what is going on inside the network. Prior to that, they have already mapped out the network and they understand it very well. And so we're trying to reduce the noise is what it comes down to being. And they will talk about how they go about doing that. Then they will go on the hunt. And they will use the tools, capabilities, what we call tactics, techniques, and procedures to start hunting within the network to see about the anomalies that are taking place and or see if there is something there that has spiked in the past that they should know about.
Do they start with, is there like a weak signal, an anomaly that is the reason that they will start hunting, or are they're showing up for duty and they're going on a hunt to look for trouble?
Right, both of those things are taking place. Oftentimes it is because of a spike that has happened, and many of the times it is just their duty that they're doing, just going out and surveilling the network, if you will. And as a result of that, because they've been out there, they understand and know what is taking place. It's analogous to what takes place with the predator missions that go on right now. As they go out and map terrain, we're doing the same thing in cyberspace. And so the hunt teams make that happen, and then they come back and they debrief. And that's probably one of the big areas that is crucial to how the department does it. And I'm not saying it's not done in industry, but again, that discipline pattern for how they go about and do their debrief is critical as well.
Yeah. What's interesting, if you look at the aviation industry, their best learning moments usually happen at adverse times.
That's correct.
And they learn continuously. And they run way tighter ships than Six Sigma. And in the industry, we're so consumed with on to the next that we may not stop to learn from what just happened.
We learn from our mistakes as much as we learn from what we do well.
Yeah. One of the things that we are making massive investments in, already have, and continue, is in using the big data tools and the security analytics. And one of the opportunities we have is to use these tools to elongate or stretch out the temporal view of the threats, so that we may have
you know, in the day-to-day, we're dealing with what happened in the last couple of days, you know, sort of in the moment. But if you're trying to detect the low and slow, you may have to go back several months and look for those indicators.
That's right.
And then compress time so that you can see that there's been a pattern. Did those sorts of tools, I know some of them originated in the agencies, did you use some of the same tradecraft that has now been, you know, published, like Accumulo and some of those tools?
Yeah, best way to put that is all of those things are being used in the department as well. Yeah.
And like General Hawkins, we'll leave it at that. Thanks for listening to Black Hat, White Hat. I'm Ben Hammersley. Black Hat, White Hat is produced by Pillow Fort Productions and supported by eCentire. Next week, I'm back in the driver's seat as we talk the scams of seduction and social engineering.